Hello, everybody. What a great crowd. This is so exciting. My name is Whitney Scherer, and I'm moderating this panel today, which is three readers of fun feminist historical fiction. So if you were looking for 45 minutes where you get to escape the news cycle and just have a good time going back in history, you've come to the right place. We're going to be hearing from Stonewall Honor winner Mackenzie Lee. Her book, The Lady's Guide to Petticoats and Piracy, will inspire teens and adult readers alike with a story about women building unexpected friendships in a society set up to stifle their ambitions. Theodora Goss, whose novel European Travel for the Monstrous Gentlewoman also explores women's friendships, in this case, those forged by the daughters of literature's mad scientists, from Mary Jekyll to Justine Frankenstein, as they solve a kidnapping case. And Laura Anderson's latest novel, which takes a gothic turn, imagining three generations of a family in an Irish manor house supposedly haunted by a specter known as the Darkling Bride. I had so much fun reading these books. One of the true perks of being a moderator of one of these panels is that a box shows up with books in it, and then you get to spend the next like 3-4 weeks reading them, and this was just such a great set of books. There were all these parallels and themes within them that kind of spoke to each other in a fabulous way, so you're in for a treat. We're going to start with Laura Anderson. Laura Anderson is the author of award-winning novels of historical romance and intrigue. She started writing seriously in 2003 on a dare from a friend, and eventually she set herself the goal of getting published by the age of 40, and she missed that goal by only 4 years. She missed it, but then she's written like a lot of books, so so cool. her debut, The Boleyn King, was published in 2013 and reimagines what history might have been like if Anne Boleyn had given birth to a son. It won the 2013 Romantic Times Reviewer's Choice Award for Best Historical Fiction. The Boleyn Deceit and The Boleyn Reckoning finished the trilogy. Next, Anderson asked what if in the story of Queen Elizabeth I. Her Tudor legacy trilogy explores history if the Virgin Queen had had a legitimate heir. Her latest is The Darkling Bride, which uncovers the deeply held secrets of the Gallagher family of Deeprath Castle in Ireland. Anderson lives in Massachusetts with her husband and 4 children. Let's welcome Laura.
Hey, I'm going to have to update that. I'm down to just 1 kid at home, and he's leaving next fall. So we'll start out with the disappointing fact first. I'm actually reading from a contemporary scene. This book is a dual timeline, Victorian and 2015, set, as she said, in an Irish castle in the Wicklow Mountains of Ireland. The who of it is Cara Ryan. She's come to the castle hunting down a missing Victorian manuscript and the truth of Jenny Gallagher's suicide in 1882. And Aidan Gallagher, who's returned home for the first time since his parents were killed at the castle when Aidan was 10 years old. The setup to this particular scene is Cara's had a particularly uncomfortable dinner with the Gallagher family. She can't sleep, and so she decides to explore the oldest part of the castle, the medieval tower, the unelectrified medieval tower, alone at night. No point panicking before she'd even properly begun. She crossed to the farthest corner where 2 walls jutted into the room to enclose a space maybe 8 feet square. There was a door here made of planked wood with heavy iron fittings and a ring to pull it open. Her heart dropped when she saw it also bore a lock. It was older by far than the Yale locks used to seal the library, though certainly not medieval, and Cara shivered, suddenly certain it had been installed during Jenny Gallagher's life. To keep her out of the dangerous tower, or to keep her in? Had Jenny leaped from the tower's height because she'd had no other way out? She was concerned that her exploration would end then and there, but when she turned the engraved handle, she discovered the door wasn't locked. It opened smoothly, as though someone were welcoming her. I am not Catherine Morland, she reminded herself crossly, to be played with by Jane Austen as an example of foolish, easily persuadable girls. I don't believe in ghosts, and I don't believe in sentient houses. Focusing the beam on the first of the steps, Cara began to climb. There was an iron rail, no doubt added much later to replace an earlier rope fixed to 1 wall. The spiral was not the usual clockwise direction. Received wisdom claimed it was for the ease of defenders swinging swords in their right hands against invaders from below. but counterclockwise. She couldn't imagine anyone swinging a sword in this narrow space unless from directly overhead. Clinging to the rail with one hand, she kept bumping the flashlight into the other wall as she went up. The first floor was as bare as the ground room, save that it had six narrow windows, three each on the north and south. The second and third floors were nearly identical, differing only in the height of the ceiling. Each floor had the same ancient openings off the stairwell, no doubt once covered by tapestries. When she emerged onto the fourth floor, she was so startled that the beam veered wildly. She had expected another bare space, but this was furnished. No, more than furnished. Lived in. At least, lived in once. Which gave weight to the theory that Jenny had been kept here at some point. It must have been her, what, sitting room? What need had a madwoman of such a civilized space? Through the dust and webs and mold, Kara crept noiselessly, as though she might disturb the absent occupant. There was a writing desk and a sofa that must once have been comfortable before mice, she hoped nothing more than mice, had made use of its stuffing. There was a bookshelf that now held only a handful of books with water damage and foxed pages, and an embroidery stand with the rotting remains of whatever had last been worked on. There was no bed. Had Jenny slept on the sofa? But then the beam picked out the stairs, continuing its spiral up, and with a sense of increasing dread, she followed it up to the last level. Here was Jenny's bed. The frame was Victorian, she guessed, a rather institutional-looking plain iron bedstead. Other than the bed, there was only a wooden chair and a table designed to fit against the curved outer wall. Kara swung the flashlight around to the extremely narrow door that gave onto the battlements. But the door did not hold her attention, for it was then that she realized the stone walls were not blank. At first she thought it was a bizarrely patterned wallpaper composed of intricate lines and sweeps in gray. She moved closer and touched her hand to the wall. Her palm felt cold stone. And now, only inches away, she could see that the pattern was not decorative. The walls were covered in writing. In the pressing blackness, with only the flashlight for illumination, she strained to make out individual words. Love's terrible fierceness. Racked with the torment of one fallen from grace. Iron bound and thrice betrayed. Though the phrases themselves were well worn with melodrama, Kara's whole body shuddered. There was a power in these words, an intelligence and passion and a singular voice that was greater than the sum. Someone, oh, who was she kidding? She knew who it was. Jenny Gallagher had written on the walls of her cage, these walls, pierced only by two narrow arrow slits and an ancient door to the outside that was indeed iron bound. Aiden couldn't sleep, tossing restlessly, his mind in more turmoil than his body. This was exactly why he'd never come back to Ireland. He'd known he would find Deep Wrath disturbing. What he hadn't anticipated was the police. What an idiot. He knew how these things worked. He knew his parents' case was still technically open and unsolved. Of course the police would want to look into it with all the family gathered together before the castle became contaminated, as it were, by outsiders. But he wasn't a police officer where this case was concerned. He was a son who wanted answers. He gave up after midnight and flung back his covers. After a jog around all three floors of the Regency wing, Aiden headed for the library. Knowing that the police did not have the missing account book and journal he'd been looking for, he would have to begin looking somewhere else. And there were enough shelves in the library to hide a dozen books. He turned on one of the table lamps when he heard a thud like something heavy falling. He turned, searching for the source, and realized that the door to the tower was open, and a beam of light swinging crazily was coming through it. He reached the door just as Kara came from the other side. Startled, she dropped the flashlight on the floor, making the same sound he'd heard before. Her underlit face was all shadows and hollows. Only when her shoulders sagged in relief did Aiden realize he must have scared the hell out of her. He picked up the flashlight. It was ridiculously heavy, as she said, "You have got to stop looming out at me from doorways. You've got to stop wandering around where you don't belong." He didn't mean that. He didn't even know why he'd said it, but her expression closed off. "Couldn't sleep," she said briefly, "and curiosity is my original sin. Here's the key." "You're welcome to explore the empty rooms as much as you like," he said apologetically, "as long as you promise to be careful. The last thing I need is someone falling through a floor and suing me. Because the tabloids would have a field day? Or because the police would be suspicious? Or maybe because Nessa would decide I'd offended one of the castle ghosts?" He was almost sure she was teasing him. "Just promise to be careful and not go wandering alone at night with only that torch." "That, I promise you," she said with real feeling. "How did you like the bride tower?" She hesitated. "Have you been up there?" "Not since I returned," he said briefly. and he'd prefer to keep it that way. I better get to bed, she said, and only much later would Aiden realize she hadn't answered his question about the tower. It had taken a surprisingly short time for Kara's borrowed bedroom to become a sanctuary. At least there she wouldn't be disturbed by imperious old women or bitter older sisters or disconcerting Irish lords with the kind of stunning blue eyes and black lashes that her grandmother had described as being smudged in with a sooty finger. Although, after what she'd found in the tower, she wasn't all that wild about having that spooky double portrait staring down at her while she was in bed. It wasn't staring at her. It wasn't there at all. Kara stopped in her tracks when she saw the blank expanse of wall unbroken by any painting. Had someone removed it for some reason? In the middle of the night. No, it was still there, just leaning against the wall at floor level. She wanted to believe it had fallen, but oil paintings did not fall and managed to turn themselves front to back in midair, because all she could see of it now was the thick brown paper glued around the back of the frame. Very odd. She hesitated before picking it up and returning it to its rightful place. She was tempted to leave it where it was, if only not to spend the night with those doubled eyes looking at her. But she didn't want Mrs. Bell, or heaven forbid Nessa, to think she'd tampered with it. Better to endure the imaginary disdain of painted faces than the actual disdain of the formidable Nessa. I'm sorry, she said silently to the white-clad Jenny after she'd rehung the portrait. All she could think of were those two disturbing rooms behind a locked door and the young wife and mother who had ended her life there.
So I realized that I forgot the most important aspect of my hosting duty, which was to tell you the format of the event and what's going to happen. So hopefully they'll still invite me back next year. But so each author is reading for about 10 or 12 minutes, and then at the end there's going to be a very brief Q&A, depending on how much time we have left. We do want people to use the microphone, so if you have a question, it would be great if you could come up, or I think we might try to pass it around, although it is actually quite crowded here. And after the Q&A, there is a table with everybody's book in the back, in the room right there, and then you'll buy the books and then get into a separate line to get your book signed by the authors, who will be sitting at a table right next to it. So, all right. next up, we have Mackenzie Lee. Mackenzie Lee is an author burning bright in young adult fiction. Her 2017 novel, The Gentleman's Guide to Vice and Virtue, won the 2017 New England Book Award and a Stonewall Honor, was both the New York Times and ABA bestseller, and garnered 5 starred reviews. Her debut novel, The Monstrous Thing, won the Penn New England Susan P. Bloom Children's Book Discovery Award. In early 2018, Lee released Bygone Badass Broads, a collection of 52 bios of remarkable historical women based on her weekly Twitter series and illustrated by Petra Erickson. Lee has a BA in history and an MFA in writing for children and young adults from Simmons College. Her newest book, The Lady's Guide to Petticoats and Piracy, which picks up the story of Gentleman's Guide but follows Percy's sister Felicity, is currently number 3 on the New York Times bestseller list. She is currently working on a novel series about Loki for Marvel. Let's welcome Mackenzie.
Hi. Oh my gosh, there are so many of you. We're a fire hazard. I love it. Okay, so I'm reading from The Lady's Guide to Petticoats and Piracy. I'm going to give you very little setup because I'd rather just read to you. Basically, the main character's name is Felicity Montague. She is a young woman in the 1700s who is desperate to become a doctor, and the 1700s are desperate to keep her from becoming a doctor. So she has, through various pretenses, gotten herself an appointment with the Governor's Board of Admissions in St. Bartholomew's Hospital in London. And imagine, if you will, this totally hypothetical fictional scenario that can't possibly be true of a young woman standing, staring down a board of white men and being asked to explain why she deserves to take up space in the world. I know, it's tragically irrelevant. You are Felicity Montague, I remind myself. You have sailed with pirates and robbed tombs and held a human heart in your hands and sewn your brother's face back together after he got it shot off over said human heart. You have read De Humani Corporeus Fabrica 3 times, twice in Latin, and you can name all the bones in the body, and you deserve to be here. You deserve to be here. I glance down at where it's written upon the top of my list. You deserve to be here. You deserve to exist. You deserve to take up space in this world of men. My heart begins to even itself out. I take a breath and it doesn't stick. I push my spectacles up my nose and look at the board. Hello, gentlemen. I have come today to petition the board on the matter of granting me permission to study medicine at St. Bartholomew's Hospital. I glance down at my notes again, ready to launch into my first argument with only a small reminder of what that argument is, but the Whig chairman, who seems to speak for the group, interrupts. I'm sorry, I must have the wrong appointment. When I look up, he's flipping through his papers. I was told this was to discuss a donation. Higgins. No, sir, that's right, I say, nearly knocking Higgins, the clerk, out cold as I throw up a hand to halt his scurry forward from the back of the room. The chairman looks at me and I amend. I mean, it's not right. Are you Felicity Montague? Yes, sir. And you scheduled this appointment to discuss a financial donation you wish to be made from a late relative's estate. Yes, sir, but that was a pretense in order for the board to see me. So there's no money, the chops man whispers to his neighbor. The chairman folds his hands and leans forward over them, his eyes narrowing. You felt the need to seek refuge in a pretense. Only because I have made appeals to several different boards at several different hospitals and not been granted permission to make my plea. And what plea would that be? I resist the urge to glance down at my paper, just for somewhere to look that isn't those hawk-black eyes of a man who has never been denied anything in his life. I would ask the board's permission to be granted a chance to study medicine at the hospital with the intention of obtaining a post and license to practice. I had expected laughter from the board. Instead, they're looking back and forth at one another, as though questioning whether the others are also seeing this terrier of a girl who dares to ask them for the moon, or if she's simply a figment of their pre-luncheon hunger pains. I can show her out, sir, Higgins says, and I jump. Somehow he'd snuck up to my shoulder without my noticing and is already reaching to take me by the arm. Not yet, the chairman replies. My fist closes involuntarily around my notes, crushing them. That yet raises my hackles, as though me being thrown from this room is merely a matter of time. Miss Montague, he says, his tone the auditory equivalent of looking down his nose, which he's also doing as he's seated higher than me. Why do you think you have previously been denied a chance to petition a hospital board on this matter? It's a snare of a question, one that I know I have to walk into or he'll lead me in circles until I trip it, and I'd rather not be led anywhere. My chin rises. If I raise my head any higher, they'll be staring up my nose. And I say, because I'm a woman. Precisely. He looks down at the bench and says, so that's our recess, gentlemen. We reconvene here at 2. The men begin to stand, reaching for their cloaks and gathering their cases and papers and all talking at full volume. I feel Higgins behind me, closing in to make good on that yet. He actually gets his bony little fingers around my arm this time, but I shake him off before he can get a good grip. I take a few steps forward and say, as loudly as I can without shouting, you haven't heard my case. The chairman tosses his cloak over his shoulders and gives me a smile that he likely thinks is kind, but is, in fact, the smirk of a man about to explain something to a woman that she already knows. There's nothing more to hear. Your case is contained within that single statement. You're a woman, Miss Montague, and women are not permitted to study at the hospital. It's our policy. I take another step towards the bench. That policy is antiquated and foolish, sir. Antiquated is quite a large word, madam, he says. So is patronizing, I think, but I bite my tongue. Most of the board is listening again now. I have a sense that more than anything, they're hoping to have a good story to share at the pub, but I'll take any attention I'm offered. Have you previously studied medicine at a hospital or academic institution? The chairman asks. No, sir. Have you had any kind of formal schooling? He's baiting the water again, and the best I can do is sidestep. I was educated at home, and I've read quite a lot of books. That isn't healthy for you, one of the other men interrupts. Reading in excess causes the female brain to shrink. Oh, for God's sake, I burst out, my temper snatching the reins. You can't actually believe that. The man leans backward as though I've frightened him, but another leans in to add, if you've read so many books, why do you need a hospital education? Because a hospital education is required in order to obtain a licensure and establish a practice, I say, and because reading Alexander Platt's Treatise on Human Bones is not adequate preparation for setting a broken leg when the wound is bloody and the bone has splintered under the skin and already starting to fester with gangrene. Then let a man set the bone and let the woman see the injured has a good meal and a bed, the chops man murmurs, loud enough for everyone to hear. There's a smattering of laughter from these men with clean fingernails who hardly know the color of blood. The chairman flicks his gaze in their direction but does nothing to silence them. Miss Montague, he says, his eyes returning to mine, I have no doubt that you are very bright for a young lady. But even if we were to consider admitting a female student to our ranks, the cost of necessary arrangements for her... What arrangements, sir, I demand... Well, to begin, she would be unable to attend anatomy dissections. Why, do you think my nerves so weak and fragile that I could not handle the sight? The women on the streets of London witness more death and dying in a single day than you have in your lifetime. I have yet to meet a woman with the stomach for the sort of dissections we undertake, he says, not to mention the nakedness of the male form, which would be inappropriate for you to see outside the bonds of marriage. I can assure you, sir, I say, I would not become hysterical. You seem hysterical now, he says. I'm not, I reply, annoyed that my voice pitches on the second word. I'm speaking passionately. Not to mention the concessions that would have to be made so the male students would not be distracted by the presence of a woman, one of the other men adds, and the rest of the board nods in support of what an excellent nonsense point he has made. It takes every ounce of strength in me not to roll my eyes. Well, then you might consider covering up table legs, lest the mere reminder of the existence of the female form send your students into an erotic frenzy. Madam, the chairman begins, and I can feel Higgins right over my shoulder again, but I press on, using my argument as a plow this time. Women make up more than half the population of this city, this country, and the world. Their intelligence and ideas are an untapped resource, particularly in a field that claims such a commitment to progress. There is no proof women are unequipped to study medicine. Quite the contrary, women have been practicing medicine for hundreds of years and have only been excluded in recent history as surgery becomes regulated by institutions run by men. Institutions that are now so bogged down in bureaucracy that they have ceased to serve even their most basic functions for those in need. I hadn't planned to say that, but the stink of the hospital wards is still right in the back of my throat. The chairman's eyebrows have risen so high they're about to disappear under his wig, but I press on. You make money off the poor and the sick. You charge them to take up space in your hospital wards. You make them work to earn their keep so less salaried staff is required. You charge absurd amounts for treatments you know don't work so that you can fund research you refuse to share with those who need it. It is perhaps not the wisest thing to insult the institution in which I'm standing, but I've so much rage bottled up inside me about so many things, and it's all pouring from me in a spurt like shaken champagne violently uncorked. In addition, I say, there are elements of feminine health that male physicians are not equipped to address and have made no attempts to understand or improve treatments for. Would you deny your mothers and sisters and daughters the most effective medical care? There are no treatments women are denied because of their sex, the chairman interrupts. We treat female patients the same as we treat men here. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a lack of research to provide relief from the debilitating pain that regularly restricts the most basic tasks of daily life for women. I don't know what you're referencing, madam, the chairman says, his voice raised over mine. I'm talking about menstruation, sir, I shout in return. It's like I have set the hall on fire, manifested a venomous snake from the air, also set that snake on fire, and then threw it at the board. The men all erupt into protestations and a fair number of horrified gasps. I swear one of them actually swoons at the mention. Higgins snatches his hand back from my shoulder. The chairman has gone bright red. He slams a book against the desk, trying to cram a lid over the Pandora's box I have flung open. Miss Montague, we'll hear no more protestations from you. Based on your insubstantial and frankly hysterical case made before us today, I could not in good conscience allow you to enroll as a student here. You can see yourself out, or I'll have Higgins escort you. I want to stay. I want to keep fighting them. I want to be allowed to finish the points upon my list. I want to tell them how I stole medical treaties from the bookshop in Chester because the seller wouldn't let me buy them, how I cut the pages so carefully and reconstructed them into the bindings of Eliza Haywood's amatory fiction to hide what I was actually reading after my mother found a copy of Anatomical Exercise on the Motion of the Heart and Blood in Animals in my bedroom and had thrown it into the fire without a word to me. How sometimes the only reason I feel like I belong to myself and not the world is because I understand the way blood moves through my body. I also want to cry, or shout at them that I hope all their genitals sprout wings and fly away, or perhaps travel back in time and start this whole meeting over and go about it differently. I want to shut up the small, nasty voice in my head whispering that maybe they're right, and maybe I am unsuited for this, and maybe I am hysterical, because even though I don't think I am, it's hard to be raised in a world where you're taught to always believe what men say without doubting yourself at every step. Before Higgins can get a good grip on my arm, I push past him, not waiting for my brother or looking backwards at the governor's or the great hall. I've never wanted to be away from somewhere so badly in my life. Thank you.
All right. Our third reader today is Theodora Goss. Theodora Goss is an award-winning fantasy novelist, short story writer, and writing professor. Her debut novel, The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter, picks up the collective stories of the famous literary scientists and detectives of 19th century literature with their various daughters who must untangle the secrets of their family's pasts. These women form the Athena Club, Their story is continued in the sequel and Goss's newest novel, European Travel for the Monstrous Gentlewoman. Her books and publications include the short story collection In the Forest of Forgetting, a collection co-edited with Delia Sherman titled Interfictions, the poetry collection Songs for Ophelia, two Tor.com novellas called Come See the Living Dryad and Red as Blood and White as Bone, among other novellas and short stories published in a variety of outlets. She holds a PhD in English literature from Boston University, and she's now a professor of writing at BU and at the Stone Coast MFA program. Let's welcome Theodora.
Hi, everyone. I'm short, so I have to adjust this. All right. Everyone, can you hear me? Is it working well? So I thought I would show you the first book. I don't think they have it here. They have the second book, but this is what the first one looks like. They're pretty, which I had nothing to do with. The artist did a great job. So what happens is, in The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter, we have five young women, unusual young women, who come together in late 19th century London. Their names you may recognize from other works of fiction. Mary Jekyll is one of them, and Mary finds out that she has a sort of sister named Diana Hyde. As the book progresses, and they find that there are other young women out there like them. Catherine Moreau, Justine Frankenstein, and Beatrice Rappaccini. The five of them get together and they realize that they were the daughters or creations of mad scientists. But mad scientists are scientists too, right? So mad scientists also have scientific societies, they have their journals, and they find out that these father creators all knew each other. And they all belong to a society of mad scientists called the Société des Alchemistes. So in the first book, they find each other. They team up with Sherlock Holmes to solve a mystery. There are women being murdered in Whitechapel. Each of them has a body part missing. And at the end of the book, this is not a spoiler, but at the end of the book, Mary becomes Sherlock Holmes' assistant. So the second book, what happens here is, I'm going to read you a section from the beginning, which is basically set up for the rest of the novel. Mary, who is Holmes's assistant, has received a letter in the mail. I'll read you that letter. So this section is from the beginning, and it gives you a sense for what the rest of the story is about. And Mary is going to work. The parlor looked as it always did, an organized shambles. More organized since she had taken over keeping the records of Mr. Holmes's cases, the notes for his monographs, his files on famous crimes. The shelves were filled with books that overflowed onto the floor. On one side of the room was a long table covered with the scientific instruments necessary for Holmes's investigations, including a Bunsen burner and microscope. On the shelves behind it were specimen jars with parts of bodies swimming in them, mostly ears. By the window stood a camera on a tripod. On the other side of the room, on the mantelpiece, were skulls of various physiognomic types, all human except the last, which was that of an ape. This morning, it sported Holmes's deerstalker cap. Lying on the sofa was the man himself, Sherlock Holmes, smoking a pipe. Dr. Watson sat in one of the armchairs, reading the Times. "Ah, good morning, Miss Jekyll," said Holmes. "We had some excitement over the weekend and missed your assistance. It was the case of Mr. Lydgate, the Hounslow butcher, accused of murdering his daughter and cutting her up like one of his carcasses. Watson did his best, but I could have used a lady's hand to retrieve the murder weapon from a drainpipe into which the murderer had jammed it. Instead, we had to use a pair of fireplace tongs, and even then, we almost lost it down the drain." "And, of course, your insights, Miss Jekyll," said Watson. "I assure you, we do not value you solely for the smallness of your hand. You cannot be replaced with fireplace tongs." "You are both in very good humor this morning," said Mary. "I deduce, following the precepts of Mr. Holmes himself, that you solved the case of poor Mr. Lydgate and delivered your murderer to Inspector Lestrade, probably with a ribbon tied around him like a Christmas present." "Ha! She's got us," said Holmes, sitting up and giving her one of his rare smiles. Mary had long ago told them not to stand when she entered the room any more than they would have stood for Charlie or another one of the Baker Street boys. She could not work with them if they were continually bobbing up and down like apples in a bucket. We wrapped him up in red ribbon and drove him to Scotland Yard ourselves. And it was not Lydgate, as you have no doubt guessed, but the local reverend who had gone completely mad by the time we got to him, insisting that he had been sent to divide the sheep from the goats, and poor Amelia Lydgate was a goat ready for slaughter. Evidently, he had seen her with one of his curates in a compromising position, and decided he had been divinely appointed as an instrument of the Almighty. I have no doubt that he would have gone on to commit another murder. The mania had taken hold. The man will be sent to Broadmoor, no doubt, said Watson. But for the present, continued Holmes, we have no pressing cases on hand. There is something... But no, it's not worth discussing yet. So today we might work on that disquisition of ears, on ears I hope to present at the meeting of the Anthropological Institute. Ears, as you know, are my fascination. Indeed, how can one not be fascinated by ears? Said Mary, trying not to smile. She could not quite tell whether he was joking. He did it so rarely. Now was the time to show him the letter and ask for his advice, as well as time off. After all, she would be leaving for Vienna in a little more than a week. What is it, Miss Jekyll? Out with it. There's something you mean to say. Holmes looked at her expectantly. It always bothered her just a little that he seemed able to tell when something was on her mind. Was it her expression? And do sit, said Watson. Wait, let me move that pile of books. You haven't even taken off your hat, and already Holmes has started on one of his hobby horses. Mary took off her hat and placed it atop one of the skulls on the mantelpiece, the one representing the highest intellectual type. She put her gloves on the mantel with her purse beside them, taking out the envelope with Lucinda Van Helsing's letter. Then she sat on the armchair Watson had cleared for her, uncertain how to start. Ah, of course Mr. Holmes could tell something was different today. Usually she took off her jacket and got right to work. Even Dr. Watson had noticed. How to begin? At the beginning, as the King of Hearts said in Alice in Wonderland. When I was a child, she began, I had a governess named Miss Wilhelmina Murray. She came shortly after my father's death and left just before my 14th birthday. As my mother's illness progressed and she required the constant presence of a nurse, I could no longer afford a governess. And anyway, Miss Murray had been offered a position at a prestigious girls' school up north, which I encouraged her to take. After she left, we kept in touch by letter, and I always thought of her as a friend. Miss Murray had been her one intellectual companion, the only person who had ever truly encouraged Mary to develop her mental capacities, suggesting books to read, telling her about the world beyond her doorstep. If not for Miss Murray, who would she be now? Certainly not the Mary Jekyll she had become. After the events of this past summer, when we solved the Whitechapel murders and the other girls moved in, after we formed the Athena Club, I wrote to her. I told her everything, and she wrote back. My letter had taken a while to reach her. She was no longer at that school or even in England. The letter found her in Vienna for reasons she did not have time to explain. But enclosed with her letter was this. She held up the sheet of paper with its elegant foreign handwriting and read, Dear Miss Jekyll, our mutual friend Miss Murray has told me who you are, and of the Athena Club. You do not know me, but I take the very great liberty of asking you to help me in my dire need. I am the daughter of Professor Abraham Van Helsing, a doctor and researcher associated with several important universities in England and on the continent. My father is also a prominent member of a certain Société des Alchemistes. Miss Murray has assured me that you know of this society and that you and your fellow club members are aware of its activities. I am, against my will and sometimes without my knowledge, the subject of certain experiments carried out by my father. As a result, I am changing, and I am afraid. The one person who could protect me, my mother, is locked away in an asylum for the insane. I am not yet of age and have no resources of my own or friends to whom I could turn. I do not know what to do. Please, if you can, help me. I beg of you. Lucinda Van Helsing, Vienna, Austria. When Mary finished reading, she looked up at Holmes, then at Watson. Holmes's eyes were narrowed, his chin on his hands, pipe on the table beside the bedroom slipper that served as an ashtray. It was still burning. Well, that would be another mark Mrs. Hudson would shake her head over. Watson was regarding her with astonishment and dismay. My God, Miss Jekyll, they're at it again, aren't they? This is another of their abominable experiments.
But the last we heard, Van Helsing was in Amsterdam, where he is a professor at the university, holding appointments in both law and medicine. That, at least, we have been able to discover. Why would his daughter be in Vienna? When did you receive this letter? Asked Holmes. A little more than a week ago. I did not bring it over directly, because we had to discuss it first. The Athena Club, you know, I'm sure you understand, Mr. Holmes. Actually, she was not at all sure he would. She had been bracing herself for his displeasure. He frowned. I am as interested in the doings of the Société des Alchimistes as you are, Miss Jekyll. I wish you had brought me this letter immediately, rather than waiting more than a week, particularly as it concerns Van Helsing, whom we know is a prominent member of the Society. You should have brought it at once. No, Mr. Holmes. She sat up straighter, if that is possible. Our Mary always sits up straight. There was the response she had expected, but he needed to understand and respect that she made her own decisions. Your interest is as a detective. You wish to prevent the society from committing further crimes. Our interest, that is, the interest of the Athena Club, is personal. Lucinda Van Helsing is one of us, and we mean to rescue her. We're preparing to leave for Vienna. I plan to go, and Justine and Catherine will accompany me. Out of the corner of her eye, Mary saw Watson raise a hand and open his mouth. He was going to protest, wasn't he? Dr. Watson, if you were about to lecture me on how a group of young ladies can't possibly go off to Vienna to rescue one of their own who is in trouble, I shall remind you of the night we stood outside a warehouse at the London docks preparing to rescue Justine from Adam Frankenstein. We acquitted ourselves quite admirably, I think, so please don't bother. Watson slouched back in his chair, looking nonplussed. Had she been too hard on him? I have no interest in lecturing you, Miss Jekyll, said Holmes, so may I be permitted to continue? He looked, well, more amused than anything else. Certainly, said Mary. At least he did not seem angry. But there was nothing amusing about this situation. If I were free, I would offer to accompany you, Miss Moreau and Miss Frankenstein, that is, if you would allow it. Here he bowed, but Mary did not believe in this display of humility. When had he ever been humble? However, I am needed here. There is a matter, not this matter of the Société des Alchimistes, but the one I alluded to earlier. It is something my brother Mycroft has brought to my attention. His brother? While Holmes had a brother, it suddenly occurred to Mary that he must have had a mother and father like ordinary human beings. Of course he must have. He couldn't, after all, have hatched out of an egg. All right, this is my time. All right, thank you so much.
Okay, so we have 7 minutes for Q&A, and if you are close to the mic, if you could come up, that would be great, or we'll try to get it to you, and the authors are just going to pass the mic back and forth and answer all your questions.
Hi. This is a question for all of you, but I'm going to use Ladies' Guide as a jumping off point.
Oh my gosh, you're wearing my scarf!
I am!
Sorry, I was Instagramming.
No, it's okay, yeah. So I just finished the book this past week, and thank you so much for writing it, because it was one of the only things that has made the past 2 weeks feel any better. And some of the things I loved about it are Felicity is so concerned at the beginning with doing things the right way, with doing things the way that, you know, men get to do them. And through her relationships and friendships with other women, she's basically told, like, no, you can cheat and get what you want however you need to get it. And so I was wondering if all of you could talk about how any of those things might have manifested in your work and sort of... What's led you to those conclusions, which I love.
So that sentiment with Felicity very much came from my own life, which is that when I was a young person, I was very determined to be the only girl in a room full of boys. And I wanted to be the girl who could keep up with the boys and who could play the sports, and I wanted to be tough enough to keep up with the boys. I always wanted, when I would play pretend with my sister, I always wanted to be Anakin Skywalker. Like, that was my thing. I always wanted to be the boys, and any woman who did not take on traditionally masculine traits was not a strong woman to me. And that's something I sort of didn't realize I had a complex about until several years ago. I realized, like, I didn't paint my nails for a long time because I thought painting your nails was, like, too girlish and too feminine and too silly. And hello, now I do that a lot. And so for me, that was something I drew on from my own life with Felicity, and this idea of, like, if I'm not doing it the exact same way as the men, it's not legit. And if I'm not keeping up with the boys, I'm not a strong woman. When really, first of all, because of this garbage fire of a world we live in, society is sort of stacked against us as women, and society is set up so that women who try to run with the boys cannot keep up because the game is, the rules are against you. And so for me, it came from that sort of sentiment in the book came from over the last probably 5 years of my life. I went to Simmons College here in Boston, which is an all women's college, which I was ready to hate, and turned out to be the best thing ever because being, like, surrounded by other women and in a room full of other incredible women who are doing incredible work and incredible things ended up being the most empowering thing in my life. And that sort of, like, turned around the way that I think about strength in my own femininity, and strength in sort of being a woman who can embrace traditional femininity and find strength in that, but also being able to find strength in any way that, in whatever being a woman means to you, finding strength in that.
So the place I got the original idea for my book was my doctoral dissertation. I did a doctoral dissertation that basically focused on monsters in late 19th century fiction. So I was reading Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Picture of Dorian Gray, Dracula, all these books. And one thing I noticed, and some really obscure things that most people, you know, don't read unless they're studying the fiction of that era. And there are a lot of mad scientists because Darwin had come along, and there are a lot of scientific concepts that were new at the time, including all those medical concepts. There were discoveries being made, technology was changing, and people got really scared. They were like, scientists are really creepy, scary. So you get the literary mad scientist for the first time being this really important trope. So in late 19th century fiction, you have all these mad scientists running around. And I started noticing that they kept creating female monsters. And not just that, they kept destroying them over and over and over again. Like in The Island of Dr. Moreau, Dr. Moreau, during that entire novel, is turning a puma into a woman. And then she ends up being really important to the action because she actually kills Moreau. And then she's killed, so she's destroyed. In Frankenstein, there's no Bride of Frankenstein in the book. Frankenstein starts to create a monster. This is a little earlier in history, but then he decides to destroy her because he's afraid that a woman monster would be even more scary and dangerous than his male monster. And this kept happening over and over in the fiction. And I thought, well, wait a minute. I mean, I can study this as a scholar, but what I really want to do is I want all these monster girls to come to life. I want them to talk. A lot of them don't even get to talk in the books, right? I want them to come to life. I want them to talk. I want them to talk to each other. And I want them to move to London and form a club and all live together and have fun together and have adventures together. So a lot of it came out of wanting to see these female monsters live, but more than anything else, wanting to hear how they talk to each other and wanting them to form a friendship and support each other. And I thought, that would be cool. So, and I was glad I got to write it.
Gothics are usually, the essence of a gothic is an innocent young woman comes to a scary place where it's isolated. So yes, Kara does follow that trope, although I try to play with it by having her be very aware. She has a degree in Victorian literature, but the Victorian set periods of it is actually the flip side. It's a male writer who comes to the castle to research a legend and is sort of entwined into this family. I thought that was a little fun to play with. But mostly, I'm going to say, just like navigating my writing and my world as a woman, the best thing that I've done is just get older. I'm going to be 50 in January, and my youngest child will graduate from high school in June. And I've just, like, I don't have time. I don't have time to worry anymore. I don't have time to ask permission or forgiveness.
Thank you.
Those were such fantastic answers to that question. And we're at the mark for time where the authors are going to go back to the signing table. Before you start moving, though, if we could make a path for the authors and do this in a calm and measured way so that they can get to their tables in advance of you guys, that would be great. Thank you all so much for coming. This was such a wonderful session. I hope you enjoyed it.